the hottest talk radio show out. The Conversation with your host, Clark Garrison, author of Survive the Next 365 and creator of The Phoenix Effect. The Conversation featuring singers, actors, authors, coaches, entrepreneurs, and much more. Reaching deep into local and global communities, teaching individuals and transforming minds and spirits. So join Clark Garrison live Sundays at 4 p.m. and Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard. And now, here's your host, Clark Garrison.
With Clark and Gail. We are broadcasting to you live from Hotlanta, US of A. And as always, the purpose of this show is to build an evolution of thought and action. Thank you all so very much for tuning in today. And by the way, if you're listening via the internet and you'd like to ask a question for one of our esteemed guests, the number to dial is 917-932-1078. And that is 917-932-1078. Be sure to hit the number one button, and we'll see your hand raised. The chat room is open, so feel free to hang out there. Shout out to everybody who's in the chat room already. Big ups to you. By the way, big ups to Dane Reed Media for producing our drop, our intro. Hey, don't forget to sign up for our free newsletter by visiting the website survivethenext365.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at survive365. You can also follow us on Facebook, Clark Garrison and Gail Smith Harris. Hey, do one more last favor for me. If you are listening right now and you're on the homepage, look up right next to the logo of Survival Radio Network, and you will see the follow button. Go ahead and click on that for me. Appreciate that. Tonight, we've got a great show, but before I do that, let you know what we're happening, let's introduce the esteemed, the grandeur, the one and only Miss Gail Smith Harris in the house. What's up, Pete?
What's up, Clark?
How you doing?
I am wonderful. How about you?
I'm tired, but I got my tea, and the missus brought me in a little snack, so I'm good.
Uh-oh. Well, tell her she can send a snack on over here, too.
Oh, no. We're not sharing. I don't share. Hey, we've got an outstanding lineup, as we always do tonight. The executive producers of a fabulous movie. I can't wait till we really get delve into this, because this is a wonderful movie. If you haven't seen it, Kinyarwanda is a phenomenal movie. We have the executive producers, Andre Eads and Paris Moore, in the house tonight. Also, jazz singer Yolanda Rayburn will be in the house, North Carolina zone.
Uh-oh.
Uh-huh. I thought you'd say uh-oh. And also, Brother Booker T. Coleman is in the house. You know him as Brother Kaba. Well, he'll be right here today to talk a little bit about our heritage. And don't miss that. Seriously. You do not want to miss this, brother. And our special guest tonight, Gail, we got it in the house, don't we?
We sure do.
Mr. Hawthorne James is in the house. You might remember him from Speed and also, of course, from the Five Heartbeats as Big Red. Well, he'll be right here tonight, right here on the Conversation with Clark and Gail.
Before we
come back, we are going to take a quick commercial break. You all hang tight. Up next, we'll be talking with a couple of executive producers. You're listening to the Conversation with Clark and Gail. We'll be right back in a couple of seconds.
Has the value of your home decreased, making it impossible to sell your home? Are your monthly payments starting to pull you under? At Taylor One, we work with homeowners nationwide on short selling their home by negotiating directly with your bank to take less than what's owed for a meaningful resolution. With over 20 years in the business and a customer service priority, Taylor One has helped thousands, and now we want to help you. Call for a free consultation at 888-882-6463. Or visit our website at www.taylor1llc.com.
Interested in having a bigger voice in the conversation? Well, we're hooking you up with 30-second commercials during the show with our incredible low rates and over 8 shows a month. So come on in and join the conversation with Clark Garrison and be a sponsor. Sundays 4 p.m. Eastern and Wednesday 7 p.m. Eastern. The Conversation. Now you can have a bigger voice in it.
Hey, this is Tajreek.
This is your boy, Philip Michael Thomas Jr.
This is Dom Hagen.
This is London Arrington.
This is Claudette Monet.
This is Anson from Dawkins & Dawkins. And you're listening to the hottest talk show around, The Conversation with Clark and Gail on the Survival Radio Network. Peace.
This is Clark Garrison. On the mic with me is my lovely co-host, Miss Gail Smith Harris. What's up, G, in the house?
Well, 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 well.
You know, it's always good when we play your theme music, G.
I know, you're playing my theme song. I love it, I love it.
I figured you'd like that. Oh, man. What's that?
I'm just laughing.
Oh, okay. You're allowed to do that. Hey, by the way, this segment is brought to you by TAMDA. TAMDA is the African American Manufacturing and Distribution Association. At TAMDA, they are working to get major retailers to collectively commit to buying $12 billion annual in goods and products from African American-owned manufacturers and distributors. We will be asking Hispanics, organizations to push for the same kind of format, thereby forcing the hand of these companies to buy from African-American companies as opposed to foreign manufacturers. This is estimated to bring back about 360,000 jobs in the African-American community and Hispanic communities. It's jumping off August 1st. Go TAMDA.com right now. T as in Tom, A, M as in Mary, D as in David, A as in Apple. www.TAMDA.com. Well, let's get started. The next two gentlemen I will be bringing to the mic are really responsible for creating a masterpiece. It's a feature film set during the 1994 Rwanda genocide. It premiered at the 27th Sundance Film Festival in January 2011 and has gone on to win numerous awards. Please welcome to our show Mr. Andre Eves and Mr. Paris Moore in the house. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
How you doing, Clark?
Yeah, thank you, Gail and Clark, for having us on. We appreciate it.
Well, gentlemen, it is a pleasure to have two esteemed guests. That's my word of the day, because we got so many on here. So thank you so much for being a part of the show. Listen, guys, how did this movie come to be? I mean, there are tragedies like this that happen around the world almost on a weekly basis. We're dealing with, you know, one now in the Middle East with Syria. And what interests me is that many times if there's not, especially here in the United States, if there's not a oil field near, then we never hear about it. What got you guys involved in this project in the first place?
Well, years ago, Andre and I decided to start our film company called Blockbox, Interactive Media Group, and we decided to make movies that were international in scope. And in that process, we're looking for stories that we could tell about our people, whether they're in America, Africa, South America, or anywhere in the world. So as we set out to do great stories capturing our stories, we went on a search. And as we searched throughout the United States, this story came to our attention. I heard about the story. I knew it was a great story. I called Andre immediately, and I said, Andre, we have to do the story. It's a powerful story that needs to be done. And Andre, making an executive decision, said, we'll do this. So Andre used his skill, his technique, and business. We arranged all the funding and financing and organizing to save this story, to make the story happen and make the story complete, and we brought it out to the world, and we were fortunate that it was such a powerful story, it won Sundance. The audience, it resonated with the audience, and they agreed with us that this was a powerful story.
At the time, Clark, I was actually in Taipei, Taiwan, and Paris, he texts me, then he calls me, and within 24 hours, I'm on the line with the writer, director, Howard Brown. And yeah, I was so inspired by what he had to tell me. He sent me a 3-minute clip. And the next thing I know, you know, we invested in the film. And the rest has been just incredible ever since. It's been a really, really incredible ride. This film is, it's so encompassing in its content because it's about Rwandans from their point of view. That's what makes it so palpable. Whereas Hotel Rwanda was basically from a filmmaker's point of view of what they thought happened, whereas Kenya Rwanda is the actual Rwandan experience through 6 vignettes that are intertwined. So, great piece of filmmaking.
Add to that, if you saw Crash, where they took 6 intersecting stories of 6 different people and how they all interacted with each other, that's exactly what we did with Kenya Rwanda, and we took real stories of real people interacting with each other in the very locations that it happened. The actors of this story are survivors of the Holocaust itself. The people, 90% of the crew were survivors of the Holocaust itself. We were in the actual locations of the Holocaust itself, and all the stories are real stories of the people involved. I don't really know of a film that is authentic as that. If there is, let me know, but I don't think so.
Yeah, and the other thing
is...
Yeah, Clark, 99% of the actors in that film had never acted a day in their life. There was only 3 main actors that had experience. Cassandra Freeman from the American side used to, you know, she was doing on-set training, you know, for the non-actors, and they did such a good job. You can't tell that these people never acted a day in their life, but, you know, it was just phenomenal jobs that they did.
I want to get into that because they lived it. You could see that their lives are. You could see the story coming out their eyes, coming out their soul, because they lived those stories. So even though it's the first time they were acting, they were telling a real story that affected them clearly, and the audience reacted to that.
Well, I want to get into that just a little more. I know that it was directed by Brother Ulrich Brown, and as you said, majority of the cast were individuals who had never acted before, many of them who were directly involved in the genocide. How did you guys come about choosing this route to staff the cast versus maybe more conventional methods?
Well, it came down to one thing and one thing only, Clark, and that's money. You know, it's very expensive to produce talent, you know, with agents and managers and things of that nature. So, you know, Alaric has a very good skill of getting people together. You know, he's fluent in French, and the Kenya Rwanda is the language that now unifies all of Rwanda. So that helped out a lot. There was trust, you know, because these people are telling a very, very personalized story. So he was able to do that. Saw the girl, I forget her name, but she's the lead actress. She was getting off of a bus. He saw her, and he said, "There's my actress right there. Would you be willing to cut your hair?" She cut her hair, and then the rest is, you know, the rest is history. It just worked out.
Yeah, and when you're in another country, you have to use the resources at hand. It's not like shooting here in America. When you're there, you have to take what you have, whether how the weather affects you, the talent of the people involved. Not that you can fly people from Europe or America. You have to use what you have at that point in time. And Alaric, being an independent filmmaker, used his experience as an independent to take the resources that we have at hand. Like Andre said, he looked at people when people walked by. He said, "You know what? You look perfect for that part," and they would accept the position. And as a director, it's his job to pull out the talent, the ability, and the experiences, and bring that alive on film or digital.
Which speaks to his genius. And, you know, when you saw the film, Clark, the fact that he was able to get the most out of these non-actors, just it speaks to how good he is at what he does. And, you know, the film was shot 16 days in the heat of the Rwandan summer during grasshopper mating season. So, you know, on a night shot, you know, you'd be shooting and they'd get the shot, and then there'd be just millions of grasshoppers. So then they'd have to, you know, put lights up to distract the grasshoppers so they could get another shot. The majority of the film was done in one or two takes.
And so, wow. So when you look at that, as an independent filmmaker, you have to make choices based on the resources you have. So a lot of times you don't have a lot of choices. So the environment, the talent, the equipment, and the resources kind of almost dictate how you make your film. And it takes a genius to take that recipe and come up with something phenomenal.
And I'll say phenomenal indeed. In fact, you know, the movie premiered at the January 2011 Sundance.
Yes.
And actually won the World Cinema Dramatic Audience Award. Now, I want to know, you know, what was that moment like? And, you know, watching Alaric Brown's, you know, debut as a director come to fruition?
That's a great question. For me, you know, again, I was overseas, and I come back, and I was kind of thrown into everything. You know, I was going from maybe, you know, high 80-degree temperatures to, you know, 20-degree temperatures in parts of Utah. So I meet up with Paris and everybody, and that was my first time meeting most of the cast, the crew, and, of course, the Rwandan cast and crew. And, you know, we're at the Egyptian Theater on the premiere night, and it's packed, you know, standing room only. And I said, you know, Paris, this is our first project. We're either going to sink or swim. By the ending credits, you know, there wasn't a dry eye in the house, and standing ovations, and I mean, just incredibly, it's one of the best experiences of my life, you know, and this is what we've always wanted to do. You know, we went to high school together, and we've been out of touch for a lot of years, and we decided to start this company, and next thing you know, we're in film Sundance, and we're winning the festival. So to see Alaric have his moment was phenomenal, you know, being an NYU grad, and
all right.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that I already saw the film beforehand, so I already knew or had an idea how powerful it was, and I was just sitting next to Andre just watching him the whole time as we were watching this phenomenon, and I started seeing a little bit of tears coming out of his eyes. I was like, I knew this was an amazing movie. I knew it was an amazing project for us first to get our feet wet with something this big, and looking at the audience and seeing not a dry eye in the house. And then when the movie ended, we got a standing ovation. And we got a standing ovation at almost every showing of our film at Sundance, which is rare. It happens maybe once or twice, but not every showing.
Yeah, and Paris makes a good point. The underlying, you know, theme of this film is forgiveness. And I had no idea what to expect. You know, in the U.S., you can be on, you know, 285 or 85 and somebody cuts you off and, you know, you're ready to pull over and do whatever. Here, you know, this was genocide. You know, families turned on families, friends, and, you know, these people actually had the capacity to forgive, and that's the underlying theme that just blows you away.
And in this time and place of wars and the economy going down, people need to hear a story of forgiveness. People want a good story. And it also has a religious tone because the story follows a priest who's being hunted by other priests, and he was being saved by a Muslim. So in this time and place of terrorism and people giving Muslims a bad name, this was a perfect opportunity to see a Muslim and a Catholic priest work together to help save people. And at the same time, this story is about forgiveness, a nation forgiving half of its people their crimes because they knew in order for them to go on into the future, they must forgive. So they chose forgiveness instead of punishment, and if they didn't do so, they would have had a civil war. So they took the high road and used forgiveness as a way to heal their company, and I mean heal their country. And this movie showing that as an avenue for a way of handling problems and handling terrible situations, that blew everyone away. You had the priest enjoyed it, regular people enjoyed it, people and diplomats or people in politics enjoyed it. It was a fantastic story of forgiveness that could be a method to be used by anyone, anywhere.
Yeah, the interfaith community has really embraced this whole film and this process. And, you know, we'll know in the next 3 weeks whether we're going to be doing a White House screening. You know, the White House is very interested in the subject matter and what went on. So that'll even be bigger. The Rwandan contingency was they were honored at the United Nations a couple months back. So it's just amazing the ride. And if you try to prosecute the atrocities that went on in the Rwandan genocide in 1994, it would take over 10,000 years. So they decided, you know, let's re-educate. So they were able to bring the country back together on re-education, which is phenomenal, that concept that it actually works.
And to see in this movie the people who actually survived this horrific event, and to see an actor ask for forgiveness to a young woman that he massacred her family and asked her to her face, "I come to you as your brother. I come to you as a citizen asking for your forgiveness." And then she responding in kind with tears in her eyes, "I forgive you and accept you as my brother." I mean, how powerful is that? And capturing that from people, you look in their eyes, you see the real emotions of people who survived this event. This is real. Even though we captured it in a technology medium, this is real. And everyone responded to it because this is a true story that will touch your soul.
Definitely, definitely. Now, I want to can you explain, I know you touched on it a little bit, the difference between Kinyarwanda and Hotel Rwanda, which were two different point of views, but can you explain a little bit more in depth how the six, because it is six stories that intertwine. Can you expand on that a little
bit? Well, yeah, that's a good question. You know, Gail, the great thing about Kinyarwanda and Alric's, you know, his genius as a director is he was in the Peace Corps and he met Ismail Netabusi, who was the Rwandan writer, producer from the Rwandan side. And what Hotel Rwanda did was it didn't tell the true story of what actually went on from their perspective. Great film. Don Cheadle did a great job. Great job.
Exactly.
But the thing was that it wasn't from their point of view, and the Rwandans didn't like that. They wanted a story being told from their point of view. So that's exactly what Alric and both Ismail decided to do. And they set out to do it in a way that respected the process of what happened and everybody, you know, today for what they're going through, through the re-education. So, that's why the vignettes kind of overlap, and because those stories actually overlap. Like, you know, with the little boy, not to give away the film, but that little boy with the soccer ball, that happened verbatim, and that was Ismail's little brother. That whole storyline happened verbatim, and he said, "I want this in the film," and they were able to put it in the film, which worked out really well. So
the entire story happened at a certain time when all these people were together in a certain time frame. And I don't want to tell you all the six stories because, you know, we don't want to spoil it for people, but one story followed a Catholic priest who was turned on by his fellow priest and his journey of discovery of trusting Muslims, when at first he didn't trust Muslims, then he grew to trust them and love them as brothers who are working to help their flock deal with the situations of this genocide. Then there's the story of lovers, young lovers, who were one was Hutu, one was Tutsi, and how are they going to, you know, deal with their relationship in this horrific time period. And then you see a couple who were breaking apart, who also married across the line. So there are various different stories, and as I said, the little child, his story meeting with the militias who were basically taking him home to massacre either his family or people they were hiding. And the little boy didn't know what he was doing. But in the end, the little boy inadvertently saved his family and parents. So all of these stories are powerful. Now, Alric has a history and background in doing music videos and doing shorts. So he took all of these short stories and put them together instead of trying to do one major story.
If you're just tuning in, ladies and gentlemen, we are discussing a very excellent movie, Kenya Wanda, with executive producers Andre Eves and Mr. Paris Moore. Gentlemen, for those, and by the way, this does cover the genocide in 1994, the country in Africa, Rwanda. It is a Eastern African nation, like many of the African nations in the late 1800s, was colonized by damn near everyone, Germany, Belgium, and, of course, our mother nation of England. Gentlemen, here's a question, because everybody, unfortunately, is not up on a lot of factual things, and although we like to believe that people are universal and international, sometimes they're not. So for those who may not know, can you just give me a brief explanation of the genocide and why it took place so people can have a little background of why this movie is so important?
Well, when the colonists came to the country, they separated all of the people that were there, the Hutus, the Tutsi, and the Twa, even though we don't really talk a lot about the Twa. And they took one group of people who were thinner and taller, the Hutus, and said, look, you guys are going to work in our offices and you're going to get the good jobs. Then they took the other people who were shorter, maybe a little darker, and said, you guys are going to work the fields. And the Twa would literally live in the woods. You know, they had no place in society whatsoever. And after a time, those people decided to leave. And they no longer supported the class of natives in their higher standing. So when they left, of course, there was going to be revenge and anger towards their own brothers, allowing themselves to be put in a second-class citizen standing. So when the Europeans left, there was war.
Yeah, the,
I mean, that's as simple as, I'm just saying, yeah, real simple in that sense.
The Belgian colonists, it's really interesting that the kind of the turning point of the film, when all the clergy are sitting down in their meeting, they play different groups of people against each other, you know, much like American slavery, field slaves versus house slaves, very interesting themes that played out. And, you know, of course, the Belgian colonists were, you know, specific to that, as the movie states. And, you know, at the turning point, a lot of people in the West, after Hotel Rwanda, they said, well, what was the resolution of the genocide? And basically, as Paris stated, the Muslims just said, hey, enough. You know, we're going to end this. And that's what they did. You know, but it was just the underlying themes were, like, so simple. And you're like, yo, so a million people die in 100 days over some craziness. It was foolishness. But yet, you know, it was allowed to happen and go on, and, you know, just amazing that type of film was actually able to be made and being told from the Rwandans' perspective. So, you know, they really...
And the Muslims were in a particular situation because they were being asked to join both sides.
Right.
You know, those who were being massacred and those who were doing the massacring. And the Muslims were like, where should we do? Who should we join? And the Mufti said, we're not joining anyone. As a matter of fact, We won't have anything to do with this at all. None of our brothers would lift a hand against another. As a matter of fact, we're going to open our doors to everyone, to the Hutus and the Tutsis, who want to have nothing to do with this at all.
Yeah. And hence it stopped.
That's amazing. Hey, gentlemen, who should see this movie and why?
Well, as young people especially, we're in the beginning stages of a college tour. I'm an AUC grad, and I think it's very, very important that the younger generations understand exactly what happened and, more importantly, why it happened, and use it as an educational piece. You know, as I said, the interfaith community has embraced it as well, so it'll have relevance for years to come. But certainly young people need to understand exactly that genocide was happening then, you know, it's happening now in the world, and it's something that needs to be dealt with, you know, when it happens versus after the fact.
And I agree with colleges. I mean, this, when you study the history of forgiveness as a political tool, you know, that's really coming to its own right now. And there are a lot of universities and colleges that are teaching people how to use diplomatic reasonings to handle all kinds of arguments and so forth. So this movie is a great way to show how to use forgiveness as a diplomatic answer to any kind of situation, whether it's between countries or businesses or anything of that nature. And, of course, people from across the diaspora want to see this, whether you're in India, whether you're in Africa, you're in Europe, Japan. I mean, we won awards all over the world because this story resonates everywhere, because there have been genocides all over the world. And what genocide story shows compassion and forgiveness for the perpetrators of the genocide? So I would say this movie is a worldwide movie, a movie that will last hopefully forever through the test of time.
And if you would, that's a great segue into, would you please let all of our listeners know where they can see this movie, and how we can continue to support it so that it has maximum exposure.
The movie, as you know, Clark, is on demand on most cable systems. iTunes, it can be purchased, Amazon.com, or you can go to KenyaRwandaMovie.com, to the Kenya Rwanda Movie website. And there's always updated information on the website. But, you know, as Farris was saying, the great thing is this is an educational tool. And one of the things that we do, time permitting, is we travel around the country and, you know, we tour the film and speak about it as we're doing now. So it just enlightens people as to what was going on and why it was going on.
You can download it to your cell phone, you can download it to your computer, you can rent it for 3 days, you can actually purchase it as a download, or you can even buy the DVDs. And you can rent it as well, and on demand on almost all cable stations.
Gentlemen, thank you so much, both of you, for coming on, taking time out, I might add, to come on the show and really inform us about a movie that I believe every single person should see. This touches all walks and lives and is very important right now in what's going on in the world today, and specifically what's going on in our communities today here in the United States. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for being a part of this. Mr. Paris Moore and Mr. Andre E., thank you, guys.
It was our pleasure, Clark.
Yeah,
thank you, guys.
Can I leave with something Roger Ebert said? He said,
absolutely.
I thought I knew something about Rwanda, but I didn't really know very much. I was moved by Hotel Rwanda, but not really shaken this deeply. Not like this. Here is a powerful film, Roger Ebert.
And Roger Ebert named Kenya Rwanda the 6th best film of 2011.
Wow.
Yep.
Excellent. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Continued success. And we'll be encouraging our listeners throughout the months to tune in and support you on this project. And, guys, when you have another project, please come back. We know it's going to be powerful.
Absolutely. Be our pleasure, Clark.
Thank you. Thank you, Clark.
Thank you.
Okay, take care.
All right.
Bye-bye. There you have it. Kenya Rwanda, do yourself a favor. Go see this movie. It is excellent. I mean, you will cry like nobody's business, even manly men, except for me, of course. I'm just joking. Hey, when we come back, we have Dr. Booker T. T. Coleman in the house. You're listening to The Conversation with Clark and Gail. We'll see you in just a minute.
Find out how to prepare for the man or woman of your dreams and more. Download the free ebook, Relationship Roadmap, the guide to getting the relationship you want, at www.relationships360.com today and get the relationship you've always wanted and deserve. Has the value of your home decreased, making it impossible to sell your home? Are your monthly payments starting to pull you under? At Taylor One, we work with homeowners nationwide on short selling their homes by negotiating directly with your bank to take less than what's owed for a meaningful resolution. With over 20 years in the business and a customer service priority, Taylor One has helped thousands, and now we want to help you. Call for a free consultation at 888-882-6463. Or visit our website at www.taylor1llc.com.
Hey, what's happening? This is Chris Cadenhead, and you're listening to the hottest talk show around, The Conversation with Clark and Gail on the Survivor Radio Network.
Hey, welcome back to The Conversation with Clark and Gail Smith Harris.
That's right.
I have so many names.
Why not?
Yeah, good point. Hey, before we bring our very, very learned next guest up, I want to let you know that this segment is brought to you by Temperature Design Heating and Air. Atlanta Metro Area's fantabulous heating and air company. Yes, sir. Hey, you know it's like 300 degrees outside. You guys, don't get caught with your systems broken down. I promise you, you will not like it, okay? Give these guys a call. Make sure they maintenance your equipment. It will save you thousands of dollars. Just a small maintenance on your system in this kind of heat will make you last through many, many years. Give them a call. The number to dial is 404-447-8265. That's 404-447-8265. Tell them we sent you. Give them a call. Temperature, Design, Heating and Air. Our next guest, G, is a learned professor and has given insight to many people around the world on many subjects dear to his heart. Please welcome to the show Dr. Booker T. Coleman, a.k.a. Brother Kama. How are you, sir? Welcome to the show.
Brother, I'm doing excellent. Hotep to you and to Gail. Hotep, my sister. How are you?
Hotep back to you, my brother.
So much for coming on the show today.
Brother Cabo, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
I'm sorry, did Gail ask
me? It sounds like we're going to have a great show. There's our technical difficulty for the day.
Well, that's a mark of greatness.
That's okay. We start off a little bit, but we end up all right.
Well, you know what? And I know you're here armed with education and knowledge, so we're going to be all right.
Yes, no doubt about that.
Well, brother, we talked off air, and I know one of the things that I want us to delve into that you thought would be a great topic for our listeners today is the migration of Africans from East Africa to the West over many centuries. Can you go ahead, and I'm going to shut up and let you dive into this and get my pen and paper out so I can be informed and highly enlightened today?
No doubt. First, thank you for inviting me to be here with you, and my regards to specifically the Atlanta family, but also anyone who's listening to this program, wherever you may be. And we had spoken earlier, Brother Clark, and we had been speaking about the Africans that had gone into Europe somewhere around 700, 710 A.D. But to really understand and put them in context, to put them in historical context, it's important also for us to understand the entire movement, because much of the confusion, some intentional, but some just because people don't know better, comes out of the fact that they, in not historically putting things into continuity, the fact that Africans were to have gone into Europe from 710 and remained there for quite a while, officially being expelled, if you want to call it that, 1492, January 2nd to be exact, you would have to go back in time and understand the movement of Africans across the continent. Because I'd like to stay specific between the time 710 and 1492, I'd like to give just a brief background as to the migration, and I'd like to use the work of Dr. Sheikh Anta Diop in his book, The African Origins of Civilization, Myth or Reality. I believe it's chapter 9, where he talks about the peopling of Northwest Africa from the Nile Valley. He also has a map that shows the movement of Africans as they migrated north and south along what we call the Hopi, or what we today call the Nile. Africans called it Hopi, Hopi River, Hopi Valley. And you have Africans that are going to move and bring their civilization, their culture, their education, their wisdom, their knowledge along this river, this great river, the longest river in the world, and they're going to move to the west, and they're going to populate these areas. And so wherever we find folk of African descent in Africa, and I'm going to leave the concept of Africans going into the world and populating the world for now, because again, with the time we have, I'd like to stay specific. We have Africans Absolutely. That are going to be in North and Northwest Africa. And they're going to grow, and they're going to civilize, and they're going to bring wisdom and knowledge to these areas. In the ancient world, at the same time, contemporary, simultaneous to the pyramid buildings of ancient Kemet, there were great civilizations in West Africa. There are great civilizations in Central Africa. There are great civilizations in Southern Africa. But because information is given to us by a people who wish to diminish the impact of dark complexion, curly hair, wide nose, thick lip, well-melanated people, they cut Africa in half. Maybe not even in half. They have what they call the Middle East, and they have Africa south of the Sahara, or sub-Saharan Africa. They're the same people. There's no difference. And Middle East is a geopolitical social term used to take away the great civilization of ancient Kemet or Egypt from Africa, and then everything else that would happen seems and appears to have come from Eurasians coming to Africa and giving them the great civilizations that is in Africa today, which is just absolutely untrue. In fact, the opposite is true. It's Africans going out that's going to bring civilizations to the world, whether we're talking about China or Japan, or we're talking about Mesopotamia, Sumer, Elam, whatever we're talking about, these are African people in the beginnings of this historical period. And so what you have is in Saudi Arabia, which is a peninsula, it is a large landmass surrounded on three sides by water. Dr. John Henry Clark, who I credit with a great deal of my knowledge and wisdom as it relates to Africa, used to say that just you would put, when you see Africa, you put Madagascar as part of Africa. He said you would also have to put Saudi Arabia as part of Africa, because Saudi Arabia, going back thousands of years, was always part of the African nation. In fact, there were times when the African royalty, that led what we call the Horn of Africa. Today we call Djibouti and we call Eritrea, we call Somalia, we call it what we call Ethiopia or Abyssinia. Somalia would be called Punt in the ancient world. There were direct relationships and families on the other side of the river, of the sea, I should say, in Saudi Arabia, that are being ruled at the same time by the African kingdom. So Saudi Arabia is very important to understand, is an African land, with no question, and all you got to do is look at the book, The African Presence in Early Asia, and to read the works of someone like Wayne Chandler, or read the works of James Brunson, or the great Renoko Rashidi, and they will delineate for you exactly who these people in Saudi Arabia are. Now, you're going to have Eurasians that are going to come down out of the northern climate after the Ice Age into this area, and they're going to populate it. And they're going to bring very little, if any, kind of civilization and culture with them, because they're basically a warrior Ice Age mentality people. But they're going to blend with the people, the darker complexion people, and they're going to create these civilizations. There is going to be a person. Now, I'm going to use his name, but we still do not have historical records of his existence, but let us just use this concept for now so that we can understand this conversation. You are going to have a place in Saudi Arabia which is going to have a temple. It's going to have a very important building complex in Ma'at Ka. Today we call it Mecca, but in the ancient world it was Ma'at Ka. Ma'at meaning justice, righteousness, and balance, and Ka meaning the spirit of. So it was a temple dedicated to Ma'at and the balance of the spirit of Ma'at. This is where the royal family of Saudi Arabia ruled. There was a move from the south, which is in a city we today call Medina, is going to move to the north and try to take the power from the royal family of Ma'at Ka. They're going to be repulsed, and they're not going to be allowed to come. The leaders of this, and what I'm speaking of right now, is the man that we now today in history, although we don't know he existed, his name was the Prophet Muhammad. I mean, no disrespect to any faith system. I respect you, but I'm a historian, and I need historical records to show me that the people you say existed are existing, and when they can present these papers, I will accept it. But until then, I will speak of it in this term, still with respect. You're going to have this movement back to Medina, and they're going to start to plan for their next attempt to attack. We're in the 600s now, AD, ACE, after the Christian era. There are going to be groups of Africans that are going to leave Saudi Arabia as we know it, Medina in particular, and they're going to go to Ethiopia, what we call Abyssinia, Pouanit, and they're going to wait to return back to the call of the leaders that are about to attack Ma'at Ka or Mecca again. When it comes time for them to make that second push into Mecca to take over the peninsula, they're going to call back, and the brother that they're going to call back is an African by the name of Bilal. And Bilal is going to also bring thousands of Africans with him from Africa to assist in this process. These individuals are going to bring a faith system and a fundamental language that is mixed with the area that is we now know as Semitic. They're going to come down into this area. They're going to push back into Ma'at Ka. They're going to overtake the royal family. They're going to establish this concept. And they're going to superimpose not only the spiritual system, but the language that we today know as Islam. And the people are going to be called Muslim. And Bilal is going to be the Muzareen, which is the caller to prayer, which is the caller of the person that is going to bring these people together to make it happen. When their leader, let's call him Prophet Muhammad, and I will also say blessings on that brother's name, when he joins the ancestors, there's a break between the followers of this faith system. You're going to have the Eurasians on one side, and you're going to have the original Africans on the other. This is the breakup between the Shiite and the Sunni. And you're going to have this movement into Africa. The first place they're going to go is Egypt, and then they're going to move across North Africa. They're going to carry the faith system with them, and they're going to go to different places until they get to a place that we today call Morocco. In 710, an African by the name of Tarif is going to be dispatched to reconnoiter, to look around to see how they can attack Spain, what we call Spain today. 711, well, Tarif is going to come back. He's going to report to his general, General Tariq. In July 711, Tariq and Africans with a couple of Eurasians, when I say couple, we're looking at maybe 200, maybe 300. They're not coming in large numbers. The largest numbers, you're dealing with maybe 6,400, give or take, Africans with about 200 or 300 Eurasians that are going to cross into Spain, and they're going to conquer Spain in 711 ACE. And that is going to become the beginnings of the African movement into Europe that is going to be the father and mother of what we today call the European Renaissance. They are going to bring soap. They are going to bring medicine. They're going to bring fruits and agricultural science. They're going to bring astronomy. They're going to build universities. They're going to begin to develop ways of eating food. They're going to change the clothing pattern of these individuals, and it's going to revolutionize a land that had been in the throes of the Visigoths and Vandals who sacked the Roman Empire. Let me stop here because I spoke quite a bit. Take a little bit of a regroup if there's any questions so far as to what we've talked about.
Well, not a question. I do have someone online that would love to chime in and ask you something. It's a gentleman who I have to say is responsible for connecting the two of us together. So I want to bring on Mr. Casey Barnum. Welcome to the show, Casey.
How you doing? How you doing? Hotel everybody.
Excellent.
And
Hotel Brother Casey.
Yeah, no problem. And thank you, Brother Cobble, for being on tonight's conversation, which ironically enough is taking place on the show by the name of The Conversation with Clark and Gail. Once again, that's not by happen chance, but you being a teacher, Brother Cobble, and of course this is a teachable moment, can you express to our listeners that up and around the word conversation, of course, which derives from written word. Where did the script for the world, where did the script actually originate when in reference to the Chewbacca Stone and the Rosetta Stone? Can you express to our listeners where did that, once again, piece of brilliance originate and essentially that actually derived all the world languages?
Well, what's very important to understand, and again, to go back in the history, nothing ever happens in a vacuum. So we have now come to the decision, when I say that, I mean just very loosely because there's so much more work to be done. What we call meduneta, what the Greeks called hieroglyphics, divine writing, sacred script, that came into Egypt. That was not created in Egypt. That was brought into Egypt from inner Africa. And the fundamental concepts that make the human being so special is reasoning, intellect, and language. Reasoning is the ability to manipulate your intellect into a language that can express the intellect that you reasoned. That's our gift as human beings. As we went through our historical life system over thousands and thousands and even millions of years, if you want to go back to the origins of life in Africa, we always were attempting to find a way to communicate. And the more we communicated, the better the society worked. And so eventually the origins of language, of literacy, is in listening. And we listened to nature. Nature spoke to us. And we listened closely in those early days before we had what we call a formalized language. As we listened, we began to speak of what we were listening to, and so speaking becomes the second step in literacy. We then began to create sounds and letters and then visual letters that responded to the sounds that created comprehension. And because nature was so important, we started with drawing nature, and that is why hieroglyphs or picture writing is one of the early forms. But out of the hieroglyphs, we drew script from the picture itself. And so, for instance, the letter A is represented by the vulture in hieroglyphs. Inside that picture of the vulture is the letter A, if you look at it very carefully. The letter M is the owl. Inside the owl's body in the drawings are multiple letters that we now look at as M. The rippled waters represented the letter N, and if you cut off those waves, it looks like the letter N. So out of the pictograph came a script, and when we combined the two pieces together, we began to talk. But that started in inner Africa, the ability to communicate, and then literacy, which was meant to record for all time and space. And that's what the Shabaka stone and the pyramid text and the writings on the walls of ancient Kemet. And the one thing that I think which we are challenged as an African people is that a picture speaks 1,000 words. A symbol speaks 1,000 pictures. And one of the things that we're finding, and when I say we, I'm speaking about the scholars far more attuned to understanding hieroglyphs. I'm speaking of Sister Rikketi Wimby Jones. I'm speaking about the brother out of Chicago. His name is Yosef Ben Levi. I'm talking about our ancestor Jacob Carruthers. I'm talking about the many scholars that have been dealing on a higher level on Medunetta. We have to stop accepting the way in which Eurasians have transliterated and transcribed and translated Medunetta, because they don't get it. Their minds don't function. The people that built the pyramids, their minds, the neurons in their brain function differently than the way our neurons, even us, we have the potential to go back there, but we're still caught up in the Eurasian way of looking and thinking about things. And it shortens our ability. It stops us from being able to really understand the great brilliance of the mind that built the pyramids. So that when you're looking at the writings of our ancestors in hieroglyphs, you're really looking at a writing that was developed from inner Africa from the very, very beginnings of time. And then they would write on the ground, and then from the ground they wrote on their buildings, and from the buildings they started to write on paper that they were able to make from the papyrus plant and from the lotus plant and from all the other plants that we have, to the point that the paper that we use today, although some of it may be artificial, basically it comes from trees and from wood. And that is the scholarship of our ancestors that is just so profound. And that comes from inner Africa. It finds its way into Kemet or Egypt thousands of years later, and that is what we're looking at today.
Wow. Thank you, Casey, for that question. And again, thank you for bringing the good Dr. Kaba on the show today, Brother Kaba. Brother Kaba, I know you had stopped at a point. Is there any way we can kind of, because I definitely want to get this information out, can I give you 5 minutes to maybe wrap up where we are?
Sure. Well, basically, when you're looking at Africans going into Spain, into Portugal, what is now called Al-Andalusia, which in Spanish means, andar means to walk, loose means light, Al is a spiritual connotation. So Al-Andalusia, which was the area that Africans created this great civilization, was called Al-Andalusia. And it was diagonally developed along what is called the Montañas Guadarramas, the Guadarramas mountain range. It went as far as the Ebro River, to the east. It went down the coast and around, and it went straight into Portugal. And so Coimbra was the northern boundary. What I really want us to walk away from is that the knowledge, the wisdom, and the understandings that Africans brought in to this devastated land that is called Europe is what brought Europe out of their dark ages. They try to call it the medieval period. It's the dark ages. They were plunged in the 1300s, they had the bubonic plague that ravaged Europe. If Africans had not brought medicine and the bath and soap into Europe, Europeans would not exist today. It literally decimated close to a third of all Europeans in Europe, this plague, this disease, this HIV virus of yesterday, because that's what AIDS is, or the HIV, whatever you want to call this, this has always been around because they carried within their system. And we have to understand that this is not a new thing. This has been around for a very long time. The communicable disease is something that was brought out of the ice mountains of Europe back into the southern lands. A lot of the diseases that Africans died from, they died from things that came from the outside in, whether it be mosquito or whether it be the flies or whatever it is. They got sick from something outside coming in. The Africans that depigmented themselves in the Ice Age, they developed diseases that came from within, and they could cough it out, and that's what communicable diseases are. And that will always be around. So we better get our immune system strong. But the Moors brought civilization, astronomy, agriculture. It was people like Copernicus and Galileo, and it was people like Sir Isaac Newton that studied the work of Africans. Leonardo da Vinci, all of them studied Africans. Copernicus studied African work. And this is what created the Renaissance. Renaissance means the rebirth. Naissance is birth. The first birth was Greek, and they got it from Africans. So African people have been the cause of every birth of any culture anywhere in the world. Because you can come to America and look at the Olmec civilization. You can go to Japan, you can go to China, and you can see the dynasties there. The Shang and the Tang dynasty of China was black. The shogunate, the first shogunate, was a black man. The Yakuza, the secret society Yakuza in Japan, that was a Kushite priesthood and priestesshood that was brought off the island of off of South Korea onto the island of Japan when Kushites moved people onto that island we today call Japan. They brought their system with them. We don't know our history. And you'll never understand, and I do understand the story that was coming, the conversation you had prior to me, the Rwanda and all of the situations that happened in Rwanda. Let me tell you, you'll never understand what happened in Rwanda if you don't understand King Leopold of the Belgian Congo. You'll never understand what the French did to the Africans in that part of the world. I'm not excusing anybody's actions and the way they acted, but let's go back in history. Let's go back and see what the source of this problem was. The source of this problem was the enslavement by Eurasians that were coming into Congo to bring Africans out. And then it was caused by superimposing King Leopold and Europeans onto Congo. You'll never understand what's going on if we don't understand Patrice Lumumba, who was assassinated in 1961. We have to know our history. We have to know the good. We have to know that which is not good. But we have to understand our history. And we have to understand that we have the potential to save this planet. And I honestly believe that is our divine destiny. On this planet, we were brought here to the West in order for us to understand how we can save this planet. The water, the earth, the land, and solar power. We got to get back to it, brothers and sisters. We got to get serious about getting serious. And I'm talking about SIRIUS. But we'll talk about that at a later date. Give me a reason to come back, Brother Clark and Sister Gail.
Brother, thank you so much. I knew this was going to be a learned moment, and you did not disappoint as usual. Thank you so much. Hey, real quick before we let you go, let everyone know how they can continue to follow you, especially on YouTube.
Oh, there's no doubt. You just hit my name on YouTube, Kaba Hiawatha Kamene. Or you can come to my email, and I will attach back to you a study guide that I developed that came out of the documentary that was made called Hidden Colors. My email address is Kamene, K-A-M-E-N-E, 777, at AOL.com. Kamene, K-A-M, as in Mary, E, N as in Nancy, E, 777, at AOL.com. And I'm also on Facebook. So you can be my friend.
Excellent. Hey, we love. We got to have you back with Brother Ashwa Crazy if we can. That would be an excellent 2-hour show.
That's my good brother, brilliant brother.
Absolutely. And hey, big shout out to Casey once again for putting you on our show and connecting the dots. Brother Cabo, look forward to having you back very, very soon, sir.
No question. Look forward to it now. You all take care, and my regards to the family. Whoever's listening, stay strong. It ain't over till we win.
That's right. That's what I've been trying to tell y'all. Brother Cabo Hiawatha in the house, a.k.a. Booker T. Coleman. Hey, listen, we're coming back 30 seconds. I promise it will only be 30 seconds. When we come back, we've got the fabulous jazz singer Yolanda Rayburn and the one and only Mr. Hawthorne James in the house. This is The Conversation with Clark and Gale. Yes, we're running a little behind. Please forgive us. We love you, too. See you in just a minute.
Hello, America. It's me, Charmaine, the author of the book, The Bait to Get Your Mate. Are you tired of being alone? Are you tired of men not approaching you? And just tired of not choosing the right mate? Well, I'm here to help. Pick up my book, The Bait to Get Your Mate, and learn how to be a winner in love. Learn who you are in a relationship, how to choose the right mate, and how to get them to commit without saying a word. Go to thebaittogetyourmate.com and pick up your copy today and become a winner in love.
Hey, we are back. Hey, welcome to the show. It's myself, Clark Garrison, and Gale Trent Harris, and we're going to move right into, because I know you're excitedly waiting, to our next fabulous guest. She is a national jazz and recording artist. She's performed throughout the world, including Japan, Europe, and the United States. She's also appeared on several artist recordings and performed at international music festivals, including her recent headline right here in the ATL,
yes.
Atlanta Jazz Festival 2012. Her
yes,
smooth,
yes.
Old jazz project, So Real,
yes.
Has won numerous fans throughout the world and is climbing several international markets. Please welcome to the show the one and only Miss Yolanda Rayburn in the house. Hey.
Thank you. Thank you, Clark and Gail. It's great to be here.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Oh, wow.
I hear the applause. I love it.
there's standing room only in here. And I'm going to jump in real quick and just say, how did it feel being on the main stage in hot Atlanta with hundreds of thousands of people just relaxing and enjoying themselves to your music?
Let me tell you, it was fantastic. It was surreal. And I'm not trying to be funny when I say that. Because I have sung, like you said, around the world, but it's nothing like coming back home because I'm from Atlanta and being able to sing in front of my family, in front of my dear friends from high school, and just from, again, so many other friends, and even people who travel from North Carolina and Arkansas, all over the world, just to come and see me. So it was really, really, it was surreal. It was beautiful. I had a great time, too.
I got to ask, how did you get started in music, period, and what kind of made you lean towards, jazz? And it's really interesting because I hate to say this, but jazz is leaving our communities and going overseas, and so many people are migrating towards foolishness. But I'm just wondering what connected you with jazz. Yeah, I said it, foolishness.
You said it, foolishness. Well, I come from a family that sings in general or plays some type of instrument. So there was always music in the house when I was growing up. And eventually, my mother and family saw that there was something there, and they pushed me all the time. So I did a lot of different pageants and talent shows. And eventually I went to Northside School of the Performing Arts right there in Atlanta when we were there, and went through a wonderful program and was able to travel around the world singing and dancing. And at the time, I wasn't doing jazz. I was doing musical theater, classical music, more of the traditional, maybe a little bit of pop, a little bit of R&B. And one of the things that I think I grabbed onto when I left Northside was that musical theater teaching. And if you think about what musical theater is, it really is no more than music to, or I should say a story to music. And the neat thing about jazz, so the transition from musical theater to jazz, and it's not even a complete transition because I still do musical theater today, but the neat thing about jazz is that it is, in my opinion, beautiful, wonderful stories told to music. And it can be done with a vocal as an instrument, or it can be done with, you know, different types of instruments. At the end of the day, what makes jazz so wonderful or perfect is that each instrument has something to say. And you never know what it's going to be. And so that's the whole improvisation of it all. But it is kind of what meaned me, I think, toward going into jazz, and that is, again, my background for musical theater. Now, why there's so much foolishness around here, I cannot tell you. It could be that, and I'll tell you this before I ponder on that point. The reason why I think it goes to the U.K. and it goes across seas and out of the United States is because in my experience in singing over there, they really love the basic art of music, right? As simple as that sounds, they appreciate the rhythms, they appreciate the beat. It's not about, you know, how funky you can dress or how crazy you can look. It really is about the music. And America is just to the point, I think, sometimes where we don't believe in our own until we see it happen across seas. And then, you know, of course, we adopt. But I don't know why we have foolishness. I know I'm not going to be a part of it. How about that?
Thank you.
You know what? It's a totally, I believe that it's a totally different mentality here than overseas. And I agree with everything that you're saying in terms of, you know, musicianship, I think,
mm-hmm.
Being appreciated more or should I say being appreciated more overseas than here. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's great to hear jazz music and, you know, stories being told. I always thought of jazz as another variation of the opera, if you will.
I think that's a great analogy, because opera is wonderful stories told to music, and it's just basically the classical form of music that you hear those stories being told. And jazz has a little mix of R&B, has a little bit of gospel, a little blues. There's a little mix of everything, if you think about it. That's a part of who we are as an African-American people. Now, it doesn't obviously mean that jazz is exclusive to African-Americans, but it certainly does, in my opinion, mean that a lot of it came from who we are.
Well, you know, and it's funny that you say that, because although, you know, African-Americans tend to associate themselves with jazz,
mm-hmm.
and whatnot, what I find is when you go to a jazz concert, particularly in the States, but more so, you know, around the world,
mm-hmm.
there are very few people of color filling the seats in the audience.
I know, but, you know, that's another whole issue, because as I said to you, I'm in musical theater, and I can't tell you how many times I'm in a show where I'm, you know, I may be one of two or three African Americans in the show, and there's no one out there in the audience that looks like me. It's a full house, but they don't look like me. And I think that's something we just have to change and continue to push for by just staying out there. I mean, I love that Audra McDonald won the Tony, and that Porgy and Bess is something that's out there on Broadway,
right.
a black musical. It tells you that we can put butts in those seats. And I'll tell you, even with Fantasia being in The Color Purple, I know people who had never seen theater before, at least in the sense of musical theater and Broadway, go to those shows because of people like her being in those roles. So there are things I know that people are trying to come up with to get us more into those seats to appreciate that form of music. It's a fantastic form.
Absolutely, absolutely. So What I want to know is who, outside of your musical family, who mm-hmm. were your influences, you know, who did you look up to and want to be like in music?
My biggest influence is Gladys Knight.
Mine too. Wow.
Really? Yes. As a matter of fact, when I was at the Atlanta Jazz Festival, a point in my show, I talked about it. I talked about how there was this rhythm that was always heard in the house, and it eventually, as I learned, was associated with her, and that beat, that soulfulness that came from She and the Pips back in the day, and it's what drove me. I knew that whatever that sound was, it was a part of who I was. And I'm talking about like at 4 and 5 years old, and I wanted to be with it. I wanted to stay with it. So
it was just classy, you know,
yep.
Totally classy
mm-hmm.
and
royal.
Mhm. Yeah, it's just a royal sound. Somehow she can take any song.
Mhm.
It could be, you know, pop, rock.
Mm-hmm.
She could probably even take a Mary J. Blige record and make it just so smooth.
Mm-hmm. And hers.
Right.
And that's a
and
skill.
It,
that's a very unique skill.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of my most favorite, I think that the best Bond song is License to Kill. I think she...
By Gladys Knight, yeah.
Yeah, she tore that song to shreds. I mean, and that's why I said, that to me is, that's my favorite Bond song of all time. But that is just, you know, indicative of how she put her heart and soul into a record and made you feel and believe what she was saying.
Exactly. Another person, Nina Simone.
Oh, yeah.
You know, different style, but nonetheless, a same
mm-hmm.
concept. You know, who could tell? I remember listening to The Four Women when I was younger and intrigued because I learned about four different women when I, you know, was finished listening to her song, and I wanted to know each of them, and I wanted to know why she spoke of each of them the way she did. So that was very impressionable on me, as well as Nancy Wilson.
Oh, yeah.
And another one who, you know, effectively takes, and, you know, interestingly about Nancy, or I should say Miss Wilson, she did a lot of musical theater in her in her recordings, and it was what we call jazz. And if you think about the Sirius radio stations or the different satellite radio stations, the musical theater channels are all coupled with jazz.
Right.
So I think they go one in one. That kind of explains, Clark, back to your question about, you know, what got me started, kind of, you know, kind of who I am and who I've become with what I do in musical theater, because I still perform on the stage in musical theater projects, and I still travel and tour with my album, So Real.
Wow. Hey, if you're just tuning in, we are talking to jazz aficionado, Miss Yolanda Raybon. Hey, I want to ask before we let you get out of here, what do you have coming up in 2012 that we can continue to follow you in your beautiful voice, your on-stage presence, and also any chance of you coming back to the ATL anytime soon?
Gosh, let me start with the last one. I can't wait to get back home. And I'm talking to a couple of folks, hopefully trying to figure out something of when to come back, because I always believe in timing. Even before I had done the Atlanta Jazz Festival, I was coming home, and I remember something not coming through. And then the next thing I knew, I was going to be at the Atlanta Jazz Festival, and I understood why that first thing didn't come through. So I wait on God to tell me what to do, I'll be honest with you.
Ooh.
And when it's time, I'm going to be there, and you're going to know about it because I'm going to let you know about it. But even, you know, before then, I'm actually getting ready to do Avenue Q, a musical, down here in where I am in Raleigh. So if there are folks in the North Carolina area who may be listening to you or even who want to travel down, or is it up, travel up, I'm going to be doing Avenue Q at the Kennedy Theater here. And then in September, and that's in August, I should say, August 15th through the 19th, in September I'm actually going to do a one-woman show on Nina Simone, which is extremely exciting because I'm going to become her and sing a number of her songs. But her story, her life story is absolutely, wow, it's magnificent. I'm spellbound after having read the script. So that's actually happening in September. and folks are interested in coming out. But I'll tell you, you can find all that information on my website in case you want to find out where I am and where I'm going next. And
well,
can I tell you my website?
Absolutely.
It's YolandaRaben.com. That's YolandaRaben.com. And I'm on Twitter, and I'm on Facebook under Yodelful Music, and I'm on YouTube. I actually have an HD video for Surreal, and I'm excited about that. It was done by some incredible actors and a group of folks here, and so that's doing really well, and I look forward to just connecting. I think my life goal is to serve people through my music, through my stage work. And so, you know, if you're out there and you're intrigued by what I'm saying or you've heard my music, please let me know because I'd like to hear from you. I want to connect.
Wow. Spoken like a true artist. Thank you so much for blessing our show. And shout out to Miss Brittany Holmes, my manager, for connecting us. And wow, she knew what she was doing when she did that.
Yeah, she's awesome. Thank you for her.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Now, tell me about it. Before I let you know, I want to ask you a quick question. I know you mentioned some greats in the past. Who would be someone that you would love to work with that may be up and coming or a little more current? And I'll shut up and let you answer that.
I would love to work with Robert Glasper.
Mm.
I love pianos, so he's a great pianist. I'd love to play around with him. And actually, we've actually connected with each other in Durham when he was here, and even at the Atlanta Jazz Festival because we played the same day. So we hung out, or at least we hooked up, if you will, the night before the festival when he was playing the jam. But I think it would be cool to connect and work with him. And I'm actually just interested in good writers. I think at the end of the day, if people listen to my voice, I think it's different. And I would love to find, a new or hot producer, someone new, because I'm into new things, being unique, hearing my voice and seeing what we could do different than what's already out there. You know, none of that foolishness that we were talking about earlier.
I know that's right. We're getting rid of the foolishness. I'm boycotting it. Hey, thank you so much. And, oh, you know what? Hey, shouts out to you because you obviously have talent running all through your veins and comes out in your kids. I heard both of your kids were published authors before the age of 10, I believe, right?
Well, actually, they wrote it when they were 5 and 7. They toured when they were 6 and 8, and they did a lot of touring when they were 10. They've been to the Savannah Children's Book Festival, and they have a website called mygrandmasbackyard.com. And the book is about their grandmother's backyard, which is actually in Atlanta. And a shout-out to my mother, who encouraged them, actually, to write the book. She challenged them. She told them that, I told her that they had great grades, and she said, so what? What are they going to do about it? And she told them that if they had a gift, and it was to write and to read, then they needed to share it. So they sat down when they were 5 and 7, brainstormed, and wrote that book. And they've traveled all around the world.
Shouts out to grandma and to that lineage. Thank you so much for giving us that tidbit. Hey, we got to have you back soon. Let us know when you're back in Atlanta.
Will do. Thanks, Clark and Gail. Bye, guys.
All right. It's Yolanda Raven in the house. Atlanta fans, y'all needed to be here. Anyway, hey, we're going to take just a few seconds. We'll be back with the one and only Mr. Hawthorne James right here on The Conversation with Clark and Gail.
All right, you guys, we are back. Mission with Clark and Gail. Our next guest is an award-winning actor, director, and a producer who's best known for his role as Big Red Davis in the film The Five Heartbeats. He's also known as Sam, the injured bus driver in the Keanu Reeves, Sandra Bullock movie Speed. He's directed movies such as Stick Up Kids and many others. Please welcome to the conversation the one, the only, Mr. Hawthorne James.
Yay!
We are so happy
welcome
to have
to
you.
Hello,
everybody.
How are you?
I'm wonderful. What a great song y'all played.
That was one of my favorites from the movie, and the Five Heartbeats. And I figure, you know, what a great way to start the interview. And I want to jump right on into Big Red Davis. You know, I was going to go there right away. Now, your portrayal of Red and the infamous balcony scene turned that character into a classic movie icon. Now, what was it like working on a film like that? And I also want to know, how do people react when they meet you in person based on the Big Red character?
Well, it's funny because during that film, we were just having fun doing a movie. You know, no one ever suspected that it would become the icon that it has. And I certainly did not. I could not prepare for that. I just thought, hell, they're paying me to do a movie, and I'm having fun doing it. And then all of a sudden, the movie didn't make any money in the theaters. It made very little money. I think it made like $5 million. But once it hit video, it just took off. And that was because the studio didn't know what they had. They didn't know how to promote it. They thought they were getting a comedy because the journey for this film is amazing because it started off as a comedy, straight up comedy, because Keenan Ivory Wayans and Robert Townsend wrote it together, and when they were doing it, it was a comedy. And then Keenan went off to do In Living Color. Robert went on the road with the Dells and got a lot of stories, and he came back and rewrote the script, and so it's a whole different animal. Because if you knew who the Five Heartbeats originally were, you would see the difference in the film itself. It would have been an entirely different film. The first studio that Robert had it in wanted another actor to play Big Red. And to his credit, he said, no, I want these people. This is what I want. And he pulled his movie out of that first studio with nowhere to go with it. And it just so happened that 20th Century Fox decided to pick it up, and then it went on from there. But the journey for that film is an amazing animal, and I'm just so blessed to have been a part of it. And so far as how people react to me, it varies across the country, because some people look at me and immediately get scared, because they may not immediately know where that fear is coming from, but they look at me and say, that guy is not fun. And then they'll come to recognize, oh, that's who it was. But across this country, across this world, as a matter of fact, people are really, really nice to me. That movie is taking off in Japan. It's taking off in the Philippines. I went to Africa, and people know that film in Africa. It's an amazing phenomenon. And I'm very, very blessed to have been a part of that historical piece of cinema.
Yeah, and I think the balcony scene is probably the most memorable scene and the most recognized and talked about scene from that movie.
Yeah, it really is. And to this day, I still don't get it sometimes. Sometimes I look at it and say, what do people like about that? And at the same time, I understand how powerful that scene is, because when we were doing it, the guy, Roy Fagan, who played Bird, we were tired at the end of the night. We shot that at night, not far from my place where I live, but it was exhausting doing that scene, because we were fighting and I was kicking him and hanging him over and stuff. I mean, that scene took about 6 to 8 hours to shoot. And longer than that, because we did have a lunch break. We went from the hallway into the room itself. So it probably was 12 or 16 hour day, and we were just tired. And I had, you know, because during the fight scene, doing it over and over like that, I had bruises. He had bruises where I had accidentally kicked him. Well, accidentally, okay, all right. But it was just exhausting to do that scene.
Well, you know, you had some muscle there. I mean, a very good friend of mine who's no longer with us, Mr. James Anderson, was in that scene. And, you know, he's a professional bodyguard all his life. So I know when I saw him in that scene, I knew, you know, it's going to be physical.
Oh, yeah. Those guys. Who's James? I don't remember which one he is.
He had the blue eyes.
Okay, yeah, because those guys in that scene, I've looked at that scene lately, and those guys in that background, those guys really did a great job. Their looks, it was like just the way they're standing around looking. It's like this is just part of their daily routine.
Well, you know, for him it was, because he was the bodyguard for Sugar Ray Leonard and Muhammad Ali and Mike Tyson. So, you know, for him, that was what he did. So, And along with you, I mean, just the chemistry, you guys made it look like you were just some guys hanging out and somebody came in and rained on your parade and you were going to let them know. Well, my office hours are.
Well, you know, that's a job we're paid to do. On top of the fact that me being born and raised on the south side of Chicago, see, I know all kinds of people. So it's like you draw on those things that you know growing up, you know, because they're but for the grace of God. You know, I could have gone in a different direction. I was fortunate in the fact that I was able to have two parents in the household who, after a while, their pounding on me eventually got to me and said, you know, I think I want to do something different with my life, because what I'm doing does not feel good to me. And so you need those people that are constantly pushing at you and telling you the right way to go. Eventually, it will get the message will sink in. And it took me a long while for it to sink in, because even in college, I was not necessarily a very good guy. But eventually, it sunk in and said, you know, I need to be doing something different. So it's funny listening to the two interviews that you had. There's a lot of knowledge there.
Mm-hmm.
And that needs to be told. And unfortunately, instead of reading nowadays, most people get their knowledge from film and television. Well, we have to start, we really, really have to start pushing that to get our message across in some way, shape, form, or. And I've been trying to do this for years. I've been trying to do it for years, trying to get an alternative to some of the buffoonery that we get to see and experience as a people. And what the brother was talking about the Africa, about King Leopold, et cetera. We're not taught that history in film and television. And that's the way we have to get it done. We have to show that King Leopold, and I know that effect that it happened on that happened in the Congo when they with their stomping on the people's neck, and why that continent is in chaos today in a certain manner. But when I go to, I see, and that's another thing though, you have to be very careful how you talk about that, because when I went to Africa, it was one of the most wonderful experiences I've ever had in my life to see those people, to recognize who they are. It was almost like being in the Bahamas, honestly. It was very little different. The people were great, and to see the things that they're experiencing. Now, there is a lot of chaos. Yes, there is. But that is not necessarily those people's fault. Some of it is, some of it isn't. I'm not blaming everything on somebody else, because we have to take a certain responsibility ourselves. But it's the same thing that's happening in this country. I was, I've written films too, and I was supposed to direct a film about a non-savory character. And when I was given the original script, what a crock of mess it was. And when I took that script and I rewrote it and talked about not the person necessarily, although the person is a biographical film, but I took that film and I talked about the society at large and what made him into who he is, as opposed to just seeing this animal. We have to recognize the surrounding influences on this person. We have to take responsibility for that and somehow get those things done. Now, we're having that's a film that was supposed to have been started a while ago, but we run into a bit of a snag with it. But it'll eventually get done. They're still working on it. But the script, from my perspective, is to talk about the things that were happening in Louisiana in the 1940s and what made that man become the person he is, and then to evolve into who he is today. The man is 77 years old and still around playing music. We have to understand the evolution of us. It's, I remember the jazz singer before was talking about Porgy and Bess, and I did Porgy and Bess. I was about 25 years ago. They did a big production here outside of L.A., and I really, really don't particularly care for that at all. It's great music. It's a great story, etc. Except the fact that we have to see it all the time. There are other stories that need to be told. When I was doing that show 25 years ago, I was a member of the chorus, and I remember the scene when the sheriff comes in, and a white director wanted everybody to cower in fear. And I said, no, that's not the way all black folks are. So what I did was, in defiance of that, I went and found me a place under the stairway when the sheriff comes in, and I just was angry with him. Just so the audience got a different perspective. And now, that's not something that they were pleased about me doing. But once I got on stage, there's nothing they could do anyway.
Right.
It's the animal. It's the way we view things that has to change. It's fine for Tyler Perry to get all that stuff, and those people in Tyler Perry's plays are beautiful singers. I don't want Tyler Perry to stop what he's doing. I just want us to have another perspective of it, to go into another theater and see a different animal. I'm not asking nobody to stop doing what they're doing. I just want to be able to go on those coattails and show a different perspective. There's a lady there in Atlanta who's working her butt off trying to get her films done, who shows a different perspective of everything. She's having a tough time, but she's sticking in there. And that's what I admire about people, their stick-to-itiveness. Don't tell me what I can't do, because as soon as you tell me what I can't do, I'm going to show you what I can do. That's the reason I graduated from the University of Notre Dame, because as soon as I got in there, my first interview with the dean of the college was, you're not going to make it here. Well, that stuck all those 4 years in the back of my head. And I said, and many times I wanted to quit, I thought to myself, oh, no, I'm not quitting, because that man expects me to quit. Five black students, undergrads, on an academic scholarship at that university of 7,000 people, and I graduated.
Amen to that. Now, you've played in, you've been in many plays, films, TV roles, and are very well respected, as an industry veteran. Now, I want to know, what's your journey in film and television been like? Why was it important for you to become a director and producer? And what would you share with young filmmakers and actors who want to get into the business?
Well, my journey, I mean, I have all my degrees in theater. I have a bachelor's from Notre Dame in theater. I have a master's from the University of Michigan in theater. And I taught for a couple of years at Illinois State University. Then I moved to L.A., and then I went back to London. I studied in London, England, at the London Shakespeare Academy. And when I first moved to L.A., I did a lot of theater. And the people that were producing and directing theaters got their opportunity to move into film and television, and they brought me along, gave me a line here, a line there. Then I got a job at one of the major Hollywood studios, and I was in their post-production department. And that's a story unto itself, where I learned how to make movies, because post-production is where you make movies, period. You can ruin a great film if editing and everything, sound is not right, but you can't make a bad movie in post-production. So I did learn how to make movies there. I was there for 3.5 years. Then my very first union movie was The Color Purple. And after that movie came out, I quit we had a mutual parting of the ways, me and the film company. And I've never had a 9-to-5 job since. But it's been tough. It's been rough, because 90% of the people I started off with aren't in the business anymore, because it is such a heartbreaking business in a way. But if it's in your soul, then you can't do anything else. And it's truly in my soul. And like I say, and one of those things that I learned in my life was, I've never been the kind of person to quit. As soon as you tell me I can't do something, that's when the motor gets to running for me. And they expect you to quit. They don't want you around. They don't need you. And it's evident in what goes on in the industry itself. I mean, look at the films. I mean, we're almost always excluded, and if we do get a starring role in a movie, we're the only ones, because as soon as you put two black people in the movie, it becomes a black movie, and therefore they won't even bother to try and sell it overseas, because it's a black movie. It's like when they said Red Tails, we can't sell it overseas because there's no white star. That's insane. That's insane. It's a lie, and it's racism to the hilt. Because you got Japanese kids who are wearing their pants below their belt and trying to get dark, and they don't want to see us on the movie screen. That's insane. That's a lie. So you have to stick to your guns. You have to decide what it is you want to do. And if you want to do this, understand, this is not an easy road. This is a monster. You have to be insane to want to do this. And to make yourself more important, you should start writing. You should step behind that camera and do everything you possibly can. It's not, most people come on a set and stand around for 10 minutes and say, I'm ready to go. This is boring. Well, I get on a set, I'm there 16 hours, and I may work 15 minutes during that day, because all it is setting up shots, et cetera. So it's not an exciting, glamorous life until you get to the red carpet. And then people think, oh, boy, look at the gowns. They don't see the hard work that went in to get onto that red carpet. And they don't want to know that hard work. They just think that everybody makes $1 billion and, everybody's rich, which ain't true. But anyway, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Hey, Mr. James, this is Clark. I can hear your frustration in
where the how limited the industry has been over the mid of these couple decades that we've been fighting the good fight. But I see you at the forefront of the charge. Do you believe, and this is kind of an abstract question to that solution, do you believe that we're going to have to start building the movie theaters and actually being playing a more major part in being the middleman in the whole stream of how Hollywood works before we really get a fair shot at being equalized?
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely, without a doubt, 100% true, because the fact we need to be, I'm hoping that some young kid one day, I can't do it at this point, but some young kid has got to say, I'm going to become a distributor. Because you can make all the movies you want to make. You can make all the television that you want to make. If you have no place, no screen to put that picture on, then you might as well not have made it. You have to be able to distribute that material and be able to get it to 1,000, 2,000 theaters and say to the Nebraskans or the Iowans, you want to go out on Friday night? Then you got to come see me, because that's what happens with everybody else's stuff. They put all kinds of stuff in the hood on us, and if we want to go to the movie theaters, we have to go see that movie. If not, you stay at home. Well, they don't put our movies in the Nebraska. They don't put them in Montana and Wyoming and Idaho and say, stay home if you don't want to see this movie. Yeah, Red Tails was not put in 3,000 theaters across this country. Therefore, it physically cannot make the same amount of money as Thor makes or any Mission Impossible movie. It's impossible because it's just simply not in that many theaters. So therefore, you can always say, oh, see, their movies don't make any money.
Right.
It's insane.
Now, I wanted to talk about a subject that you brought up on Facebook a few weeks back. The Canadian and European entertainment industry has pretty much, I call it the takeover of Hollywood. Why do you think that so many Canadian and European actors are flocking to the U.S., and why are they, particularly the Canadians and Europeans of color, having so much more success in today's Hollywood than Americans are?
Well, that in itself, it takes a while. But for me, it's like, look at all the coverage that the royal family gets. Why are we interested? I'm not interested in I'm just not interested in them. I could care less what they do. But there's still that whole connection between this country and England. There's a strong tie. It's almost like a lot of people in this country wish that we were still part of the British Empire. Because that's what they concentrate on, that whole British thing. And everything British is always better.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, if you have British people, they're better actors. It doesn't matter if you've been trained or not. They're better at it. Canadians are still part of the British Empire. So they're better at it. It's that whole mentality of feeling inferior to something else. So therefore, those people can come in here and take over all the roles, because that somehow intellectually and creatively and talent-wise, they're better than the people in this country. So therefore, they have a magic about them. Therefore, we got to use them, don't we? But that's a simple explanation of it.
Yeah, I mean, because one of the stars of Red Tails
is British.
Yeah, well, he's a British actor.
Yeah.
It's
an insult to the African-American guys who are really working their butts off to learn their craft. Now, I'm not mad at the guy for getting a job. That's not the thing. Don't get me wrong. He has a right to work just as anybody else, but it's too one-sided. This is our money. This is the money that we're putting into those pockets. And if we can't be a participant of that money that we are actually spending, if we can't see our own, if some kid out of Detroit does not have the same feeling of I can achieve as some guy from Gloucester, then something's wrong. Those kids from the south side of Chicago don't have that hope because they don't see themselves on that screen. They don't see themselves writing. They don't see themselves producing and directing. Therefore, there's no hope for them. So therefore, they turn inward on themselves. And therefore, when you turn inward on yourself, you turn outward onto somebody else and strike out because you don't like yourself and you have no hope. What's wrong with this picture? That has to change.
Exactly.
And I've been doing that. I've been trying to change it all my life, and I'm not stopping now. I've been fortunate enough to be able to be in some films, the great films like Speed. Speed is a tremendous, tremendous action movie, and I was fortunate enough to be there. But I was the only black person at certain times on that set. Joe was the police captain was in there. But there was nobody on that crew. There was not one black person on the crew of Speed until we got to Watts. And then they hired some guys to be to watch the set. But other than that, there was not even a black person sweeping up the set.
Wow.
But there was that genius cameraman, Jan DeBont, who this was his first directing job. He's a genius cameraman. And I don't use genius very often, but he's genius. And all those little young white kids were able to soak up that knowledge without even knowing they were soaking up knowledge. Where's the black kid running around there handing film off to somebody soaking up that knowledge so he can be that, take that next step? That's my problem with this whole situation, and that's what I'm trying to change. The brother was talking about, I'm sorry, forgive me if I don't know his name, but he was talking about the Moors, et cetera. The stick-up kids, that's what's important about the stick-up kids to me, is the fact that that movie, the stick-up kids, it was a name that was used to get people to watch the movie. But
right.
That's not what the movie is about. That movie is about our history, and it's very subtle. I'm not trying to hit you over the head with it. If you go into the theater, if you watch the movie on DVD and you just be entertained, that's all good. But if you come out of there and say, wait a minute, they were saying some things that I didn't know. Let's talk about this. Let's go back. Let me go get me a book and see if what they're saying is true. Don't take my word for it. You do your research. Every black person in this country was not brought over here on the slave ships. Black people, Africans, were here before Columbus came, before Leif Erikson came. That's what we talk about in that movie, very subtly, but it's there.
Well, I wanted to segue into Stick-Up Kids because Stick-Up Kids introduced the world to a beautiful young actress named Holly Joy Gaines, who happens to be from my hometown, Pittsburgh, actually was one of my childhood best friends. And I wanted you to just expand a little bit on the film and tell folks where they can go get the film, because it has been on BET, but I know mainly now you can get it for sale. So if you can give the listeners some information, that would be great.
Yeah, it was on TV1 last summer. Not BET, but TV1 played it. And it played for like 3 months on TV1. But it chopped it up so bad. But you can always just go online and order from Amazon. You order from Amazon, you order just go online and find it. It's called The Stick-Up Kids. And Holly Joy Gaines, see, that's another one of those things that really ticks me off. Holly hadn't done anything since then. She's a very good actress.
Yeah.
And for her not to be able to work is disgusting. There has to be a way for talented people to be able to work. And we have to, I mean, you know, Tyler Perry has employed a lot of people, but he's not the only person out here in the world. We have to be able to do it. We have to take responsibility, and I do take that responsibility because every day of my life I'm out here trying to get something done of a different nature. But the stick-up kids, go see the stick-up kids. Get it, rent it, whatever you have to do. You can find it. It's easy.
It is a wonderful movie.
Oh, it was so much fun to do, and that was my first film that first feature film I directed. I've directed a lot of theater. I've directed tours of plays and stuff, but that was my first feature film that I directed. And that, to have the control of what goes on that screen, I'll never turn back, because my role model is Clint Eastwood. That's who I want to be. because he gets to direct, he gets to produce, and he gets to act in things that he wants to do. So if he can do it, why can't I do it? There's no excuse for it.
Right.
So that's what and hopefully every time you go see a film that I'm involved in, you know it's not going to be something of just junk. It's going to be something that you're going to be able to come out with, and I'm going to be able to keep my head high, and you're going to be able to feel good about yourself, because it's important for me to portray black men in a positive manner. Yeah, we got bad guys. Somebody's got to play the bad guy. But there are other things, there are other subtle things that we can do to be able to put us in a better light than the way we're always shown. And that's what I want. We can keep all the other stuff you want, but let's get a balance of it. For every married with children that they got, there's always 10, 15 other dramas showing them in a positive light. That's all I want. Just fairness. Don't give me anything. I'm earning my way.
Mr. James,
keep going.
Mr. James, I've got to ask you so people can know, what's up next for you in 2012 and beyond?
2012, well, the film I'm working on, trying to get this film done. I won't say the name of it. I'll let you know when it's right. I'll tell you the name of it. But that's what I'm working on right now. I did an episode of, I don't know if y'all ever watched this show, Workaholics. What a goofy little show, but it was fun to do. It's you know, I love doing all that kind of stuff. That's coming out next week, the episode that I did. I've got some theater that I'm going to be doing this year. So it's just a matter of just doing anything and everything that comes across the plate that I want to be involved in.
Perfect. Hey, before we let you go, please. Pretty please tell everyone where they can keep up with you on social media or on Facebook or any other site that you may be on. And also, before we let you go, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you to please let everyone know for the last time your office hours.
Oh, you know it, Dave. That's one line I never say. I never say that line. I let everybody else say it. Because that to me has become a precious icon to me, and it won't come out my mouth. People come up to me every day of my life, talking about what's my office hours, and then they'll say it. But I never say it. I make them say it. And people ask me, please say it. Please say it. Nah.
I'll go ahead and say it. For Mr. Hawthorne James, the office hours are from 9 to 5.
It is. And you can hit me up on Facebook. You know, I got all kinds of friends on Facebook. I got, filmmaker. Down in Atlanta, Carla's on there, and hit Carla up. I mean, all kinds of people. I got friends in D.C. and Lisa here in L.A. and, you know, all kinds of friends, R.N.A., all kinds of folks I know. Hit them up because they're all doing something positive. Nurses and mothers and filmmakers. Let's get together and talk to each other. You let me know what you need. I will try and help you out.
He definitely will.
Before we let you go, I think someone might want to have a question for you. Call them real quick, 404, last four digits of 2811. You've got 1 minute. What's your comment or question?
Hey, Hawthorne, it's Carla. You already know how I feel.
I know how you feel. This is the young lady that's the filmmaker in Atlanta that I was talking about.
Hey, Carla.
Hey,
how you doing?
Hey, Carla.
Hi.
We'll have to have you on the show.
I my support for Hawthorne. He already know how I feel. He's helped me so much, and he's unselfishly helped me with my package because I'm in the middle of pitching, and he's going to play the lead in that one. I'm just looking forward to working with him and on many other projects that I have going on. He's an awesome guy, awesome friend. He's my mentor, and I just truly wish him nothing but the best.
Thank you, Carla.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Hawthorne James, thank you so much for stopping by.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you very much for listening to my ramblings.
It was our pleasure.
Okay.
All right, and I guess that'll do it for us today, Clark, huh?
I know. Wait a minute. Hold on. You keep talking. I got to play you a little favorite song you've been telling me I better play, so let me get it going. Are you happy?
SWV, this is the new one from SWV, Clark.
Yes, whatever.
Hey, we got to thank everybody real quick for being a part of the show. Brother Kaba Kiyawatha was on the show putting it down. You might know him as Booker T. Coleman. We also had the executive producers of the acclaimed show. Oh, wait a minute, hold on.
What is going on with you, man?
I dropped something. Carry your watch on the house, and that was Mr. Andre Eves and Paris Moore. Hey, shout out to Jazz Phenom, Mr. Yolanda Rayburn, and of course the Hawthorne James in the house. Ooh, I got it in. Shout out to the boss as always.
Hey, Jonathan.
I know, right? Tune in tomorrow night, 9 p.m. for Village Creates Radio with William Harriet. 9 p.m. right here. Hey, G, we got another one in the books.
I know. Join us next Wednesday at Cass Cafe. That works.
That's right. That's right. Eat Wednesday, in. July 18th at Cass Cafe. If you are somebody, you better be in the house. It starts at 8 p.m. Cass Cafe is in Midtown. You can find it. Be there or be square. It is the Survival Radio Network's official launch party. Everybody will be in the house. The who's who will be there. Hey, Casey, big shout out to you, man. Come on down to Hot Atlanta from Jacksonville. Stop playing. G, I think we're out of time. So we're going to pump this SWV. They are back, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of myself, Clark Garrison, and the G-Meister, Gail Smith-Harris, I bid you adieu. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.